Hello, welcome to the very first of the Yin Jamara Talks podcast. I'm Stan Grant.
And I'm Jack Jacobs.
Now, what you're going to hear in this podcast in the weeks and months ahead are discussions with smart people, with new ideas, people who are going to make you think about the world. If you think you knew the world, we might make you think about it again. What is democracy? What is freedom? What is love? How do we live together in a planet that is so interconnected, so small, and yet so burdened with the weight of our history? What is peace? How do we find peace in a world seemingly of unending conflict? And we're starting the very first program with an idea that is front and center right now. It's the idea of democracy. Democracy around the world is in retreat. We know that. Freedom House counts 15 straight years of declining freedom and democracy in the world, and there have been political strongmen, ideologues, demagogues who have exploited the fear and anxiety that is growing within democracies themselves. And you have, at the same time, the rise of authoritarianism. So we're here in this coffee shop. Funnily enough, it's a Hong Kong coffee shop, Jack, which is very apt because China is front and center, isn't it, in this question about democracy right now.
It is, Stan. You know, we were talking before this podcast about that classic phrase from Churchill.
Yeah.
Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other ones.
I hate that phrase.
Tell me why you hate it.
I hate it.
Why do you hate it?
Because of course it is for him. Mm. It was made for him. Mm. Democracy was designed for people like Winston Churchill. How easy it is to say when you're a lord of the realm than if you are someone at the bottom of the pecking order of democracy, left out, abandoned, left behind. What do you say to an Aboriginal Australian? What do you say to a Native American, to an African American, to an Appalachian farm worker, to a Rust Belt factory hand that has seen his factory shut down, to loss of trust and faith? It's so easy to say, what a cop out. Oh, it's the worst of all. That's the best we've got.
See, this is the thing, Stan. Churchill,
what a measurement.
Churchill was speaking out against the alternatives of fascism, of the USSR-based socialism. Our world is different today. We're seeing the rise of China, which is based on a kind of shifting model between socialism and a kind of Chinese nationalism. We're seeing Russia invading Ukraine. Mm. We have seen the failure of nation-building democratic projects in Iraq and Afghanistan that have been caused by the hubris of a West that thinks democracy can and will work everywhere.
Well, it's tied to liberalism, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? Since the end of the Cold War, the crowning glory of liberal democracy, Fukuyama's end of history moment, we've basked in the glory of liberal triumph. And we thought we were all heading to the same destination. But liberalism is a poison chalice. Yes, it promises freedom. Yes, it promises to be able to govern over diversity. It's a liberating idea, and yet it is weighed down with the baggage of history. It's a religion unto itself. Mm. Things will always get better. Why? Because we're liberal, and liberals make things better. Mm. And we look around the world at environmental degradation, at people left behind, growing inequality that's a cancer on democracy, people knocking on the gates of countries that they can't get into because of wars, where you find the hand of liberal democracies in those conflicts. Mm. It's not enough to just say it's better than all the rest. It's not enough to say liberalism will deliver us to this Valhalla. What do we do with it?
Mm. Of course, Sam, there have also been figures from the other side of history who have drawn on the language of liberalism to try and fight back against its abuses. You know, I think of Dr. Martin Luther King, I think of Mahatma Gandhi, I think of Rosa Parks, I think of someone like William Cooper here in Australia, or a document like the Uluru Statement.
Yeah.
What do we make of, at this point in time, those who sought to use the language of liberalism against the abuses of liberal democracy?
I think they were torn.
Yeah.
The Martin Luther King who talks about a dream, it is content of character, not colour of skin, that determines someone's fate, is not the Martin Luther King that goes to his death, shot from a hotel balcony. The Martin Luther King who, before his death, on that night, was preparing a speech entitled "Why America May Go to Hell." That's not the Dream King. That's the hard realist king. I think people are sort of seduced by the liberal promise. It's a tantalizing idea. And like so many of these dreams, you get up close and you find that you can't grab them. Mm. You can't touch them. They slip through your fingers. What does liberalism really promise us? It promises us liberation from all, mm. from faith, from family, from nation, a view from nowhere that can easily be a view of nothing. Hollowed out communities where people no longer have a sense of who they are, let alone whether they can see each other in the other person. So that's the crux of the matter. And the really fundamental question, that's the question we're asking today, and we're going to be going to our guest on this soon. Is it worth saving?
There's also this veneer too, Stan, of a kind of proceduralism that says that a liberal democracy can treat everyone in and of themselves as human beings, free of their history, their gender, mm. their race. To what extent is that a cover for inequality in our world today? Because we're seeing resentment coming from identity-based movements from around the world, coming to rise against liberal democracy and tear it down. Is there any way you think in which liberal democracy could be salvageable to address those identity histories?
It has to be able to come to terms with its own history, because liberalism has a history problem. It's founded on the idea of historicism, that there is an endless march of progress. Yes, as Hegel said, history is a slaughterhouse, a slaughter bench, but it will deliver us to a place of freedom, a utopia, where the master and the slave no longer have to recognize each other mm-hmm. as so. And there's always the view of tomorrow, the promise that things will get better. You know, the Steven Pinkers of the world who talk about that we've never lived in a better time. This is the fulfillment of the Enlightenment. Try telling that to someone in Ethiopia, in Tigray, where at least 500,000 people have died in the worst conflict in the world right now. Try telling that to someone in Yemen, a woman under the boot of the Taliban in Afghanistan, someone living in North Korea. Tell that to an Aboriginal person living in Wilcannia in New South Wales, in one of the richest countries in the world, where the life expectancy of an Aboriginal male is 37. Yeah. Tell me about the promise of liberalism. This didn't exist, and now it exists. What a great thing.
So my first guest today on our Yindjimara podcast is Professor Mark Evans. Professor Mark Evans is Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at Charles Sturt University, former Director of Democracy 2025, and the co-author of a new book with Jerry Stoker called On Saving Democracy. So Mark, your new book is called On Saving Democracy. Why does democracy need to be saved?
Well, it needs to be saved for four main reasons. First of all, I think it has been a remarkably successful project of human empowerment, and it's led to great progress in terms of social and economic development. So if you look at most indices of social economic development that have been developed over the last 50 years, we've seen a steady rate of progress occurring. And in general, in democracies, we've seen the abolition of what Karl Marx called brute scarcity. Mm. Right? So in terms of social and economic development, there has been progress as a consequence of the onset of democracy. Secondly, it could also be argued that in the large scale democracies, there's been less conflict since the onset of democracy. Ironically, there's been more conflict potentially between non-democracies and democracies, mm. but nonetheless, within the democratic community, there has been less conflict. So you could argue that it's been a successful tool of peace building, particularly in Europe. And obviously, the European states were the most ravished by conflict. But since the end of the Second World War, with the onset of maturer democratic settlements, and obviously forms of supranational governance, there has been less conflict. Mm. Thirdly, I would argue that as a culture or as a way of life, democracy has enabled more inclusive societies. So in my view, democracy, because of course this is contested, is based upon the twin concepts of popular control and political equality. And these provide the foundations to a free society. And the evidence suggests those societies in general tend to be more inclusive. There are some exceptions to the rule, but in general, they tend to be more inclusive. And so I would sort of look at as evidence of that my parents. Both my parents were brought up in public housing estates. We did the old ancestor.com DNA tests recently. And really, until my parents, the Evanses had contributed very little to the world apart from with their hands. You know, they were miners. They were some skilled artisans. But it wasn't until my parents had the opportunity to go to grammar school through an open competitive examination that we had an Evans that went to university. And they then went to Oxford University. They became professors in political theory. All of our children, their children's children, have gone to university, mostly to Oxford University. So that sense of public value creation in the context of literally one to two generations demonstrates the importance of an egalitarian approach to education that emerged through the democratic settlement at the end of the Second World War that improved the freedoms of particularly working people. And then, look, finally, the survey data tells us that most citizens around the world support democratic values. They support free and fair elections, the rule of law, the separation of powers, freedom of speech and assembly, social and political equality. But it's the failure of governments to uphold those values that is viewed to be the problem. Right? So the argument is that it's governments that have failed to deliver on the liberal promise.
It's an interesting argument. You certainly make a compelling case about the end of brute scarcity and socioeconomic mobility, and that's been reflected in my own life as well. And yet we know that we are hitting the wall all around the world on this. We know that there is growing inequality that is a cancer in democracies. In the United States, life expectancy in the richest country in the world is going backwards. People are locked out and potentially will never work again. The capacity of democracy to deliver on the promise of human flourishing now appears to be in question. And then there is the legacy of history. And what you've described, of course, is the sort of transformative capacity of democracy. But we also know that it landed on people differently. It was exported at the barrel of a gun. And there is a deep, deep history problem. What about those people, Aboriginal people here, Native American people, African American people, the poor, the left behind, the people who don't feel as if it speaks to them? How do we make democracy meaningful for them?
So look, what you're articulating there very eloquently is what I would call the failure to deliver on the protective powers of democracy. Amartya Sen refers to protective powers of democracy. And one of the main major reasons for this, and it does manifest itself differently in different countries, but essentially there's been a disconnect between the political elite, right, and what I would call the exiguously participating electorate. There's been a division of labor between the professional political class, right, and the everyday citizen. And we've seen the way in which political projects through political parties have been organized around fueling the culture of contentment. In other words, most political parties seek to win elections and to build political coalitions that will deliver votes for them. And that has been antithetical to particularly minority groups and minority voices. Okay, so it's been the dictatorship of majoritarian politics against the rights, particularly of minority groups. Democracies around the world have failed to protect minority rights effectively. And there's been a failure of political parties, particularly parties of the left, the so-called emancipatory parties, right, to protect the rights of the minority and forward their interests decisively within their political projects. All of those parties of the left to be successful have had to lurch to the centre and to appease the culture of contentment, as J.K. Galbraith has put it. So for me, it's partly a failure of political parties. It's partly an inability for some political systems to generate multi-party systems that adequately represent the different pluralities that exist within our societies. But also it has basically been a failure to deliver on the liberal promise of political and social equality. So social equality is lagged behind political equality. So we have the vote, right? We have the vote, and that's been a great progress, but we've not seen the same type of social entitlement enshrined within our societies that will create the freedoms necessary for all classes, ethnicities, and groups to flourish.
Mm. You may have heard a rattle there, my coffee. We're in a Hong Kong coffee shop, and Mark, there's a wonderful thing that I got into when I was in Hong Kong. It's called a yin yang. It's a half coffee and half tea, and it really gives me the lift that I need. So you may hear that in the background. Jack, one of the things that Mark's raising there is a really fundamental question that I wrestle with, and you may want to put this to Mark. Is this where liberal democracy ends up? Is it a design fault? Does it ultimately lead precisely to the lack of social capital that Mark is talking about? It may bring about an economic benefit, but what about how it speaks to the soul?
Because this is the inbuilt difficulty of democracy, isn't it, Mark and Stan, that it's dealing with different people who have often contrary interests that can't so easily be resolved. So what happens to your soul, to your identity, to your sense of self, and that it becomes fragmented and shattered? I mean, one of the key reforms that you recommend in your book, Mark, are citizens' assemblies, you know, trying to encourage deliberative democracy, the direct involvement of ordinary people who come with all of their difference to solving policy issues that affect them. But one of the questions I have, for example, in the United States is, how would a citizens' assembly handle the discontent and anger and rage and resentment of a Make America Great Again person and supporter of Trump? You know, how do you incorporate resentment into a forum like a citizens' assembly so as to come to meaningful compromises on policy that affect people who don't actually agree? How can we actually improve the reforms that we introduce into our system to allow for that difference to work itself out meaningfully?
So that's a great point. This points to what I would call kind of the new enlightenment type ideas. And what that means is that there's really very compelling evidence, and I'll give you an example in a moment, of where once people engage in reasonable conversation, engage in reason, where they're exposed to the range of evidence across a particular issue, where they're able to engage in Yindyamara, where they're able to basically engage in sharing wisdom, respectfully listening to each other, listening to experts, and engaging in collaborative problem solving, they do change their minds. So, for example, the London School of Economics was desperate to get a citizen assembly up on Brexit. And in the end, they didn't get government support for that, but they went ahead anyway. And they deliberately invited to that assembly more Brexiteers than pro-Europeans, right? Deliberately. Because they'd read the research evidence, and they thought it was worth the risk, basically, to allow reason to prevail. And it did. Basically, they recommended staying within the European Union, right? So deliberation using new Enlightenment principles, I think, is critical to this. And I have to say, my experience as well, particularly in Afghanistan, working in very conflicted societies, is where you do give issues time, where you do give deliberation a chance, where even when you bring very strange bedfellows together, they will start to work things out. They will start to develop relationships. Yeah. And there's lots of examples, not just in Afghanistan, where I saw that occurring in community development councils, but the Good Friday Agreement, for example, was a classic example of that.
Yeah.
Right. And also the back channel deliberations between the ANC and the apartheid regime over the future of South Africa was another example. Mm. Because when you actually get down to issues of the future, and you have to be very futures focused to achieve this, when you ask people, you know, what matters most to them, normally there's very, very common issues. And it's basically about, in Afghanistan, making sure that there's food on the table, right? That they're not, that their everyday lives aren't disturbed by conflict, right? And that their children have the ability basically to live good lives. And the reason why I essentially still believe in the efficacy of democracy is, for me, it provides the best possible recipe for leading a good life.
Mark, but conflicted societies turn on the question of power. And when you have powerless groups in the society, bringing them to the table, inevitably there is a power differential. How does liberal democracy deal with that? And the voice to parliament may be an example where a powerless group in Australia is seeking a voice to speak back to power. How do we deal with the power differential in historically conflicted societies?
Well, look, I have to say that I am a big sort of fan of Aaron Lippert in relation to this and the concept of consociational democracy. The evidence tells us very, very clearly that in divided societies, those societies that stay wedded to majoritarian principles do not make progress.
Mm.
Right? So the majority has to empower the minority. The minority has to be privileged in these deliberations in order to get the outcomes that you're trying to achieve. And obviously, there's a number of examples of how that's prevailed across the world. I mean, obviously, Switzerland is an example of that. Belgium is another example of that. We've seen the way in which, even in citizens' assemblies, right? And this is kind of an idea that goes the other way. We know that the Irish Constitutional Citizens' Assembly was very successful because it was a mixture of two-thirds citizen, everyday citizen, and one-third politician. And the reason for that was, it was kind of the reverse of consociationism. It was arguing that in order to make politicians take renewal seriously, you have to involve them in the process of change, and you have to bind them to decisions that are made in that assembly so that they will take those decisions seriously moving forward. So in different ways, you need to challenge majoritarian politics on the basis that the new Enlightenment requires the empowerment of minority voices to make progress on the big social and political issues that we're confronting. So look, that's my view on that. Consociationalism is the key to this. Now, how that would manifest would depend on the character of the conflict that you're looking at. But for example, I saw a very interesting article the other day, which was basically about how do you address the issue of representativeness for First Nations within the Australian Parliament in the context of a period of democratic renewal. And the author was arguing, well, we need to think about the first democracy principle, which is if there hadn't been an invasion, right, in Australia, what would representation look like in terms of First Nations, in terms of the First Nations community? What would the size of the population look like? Mm. And how could you project representative issues to our present parliament? So, for example, so he argues basically that the size of the First Nations population would probably be roughly about 9 million, right, if there hadn't been an invasion. Mm. So basically the argument, well, what does that look like in terms of representation in the contemporary parliament?
Yeah. Right? Is it good luck? Good luck getting that passed.
I know, absolutely. It would be very, very difficult to... Right.
As a final point, if democracy has a virtue, it must be its capacity to inspire. It must be that it asks us to come together despite our differences and to try and forge and negotiate out of a common future. Now, we know in practice that's an extremely difficult thing to do, that it's a path riddled with inequality, often violence too. What would your hope be in democracy for its capacity to inspire us, as a final point?
Well, I actually think it's actually more about what democracy can provide through education and empowerment. So for me, the solution to most of the problems that we're confronting in democratic politics today is the importance of an active citizenry, right? Of an educated, active citizenry that is choosing freedom, right? Because my view at the moment, particularly, and it's been more of a problem, I think, in Australia than in the other country that I've spent most of my life, which is obviously the UK, is that there's been a tremendous degree of apathy in Australia as a consequence of affluence, really, over the last 30 years. You know, if we look at those countries that have made the biggest changes in relation to democratic renewal, they're countries that have been through some form of crisis, an economic crisis or some form of social crisis, but it's been crisis-driven reform. We've not had that in Australia. And by and large, we have, as I've said earlier, a culture of contentment. We've had low levels of activism and associative culture. And until we are able to educate a much more active culture of citizenship in which people themselves seek to engage with the protective powers of democracy and use the protective powers of democracy and hold their politicians to account and their institutions to account, then I think progress is going to be slow.
Thank you, Mark. That's the first of our Yindjimara Talks, Saving Democracy with Professor Mark Evans. As we said, we want to bring thinkers to you who make you think again. And Mark, you've certainly done that. Some of the ideas I suspect are out of our reach right now, given where our polity is at, but we have to aim high. So thank you again for joining us on the first program.
Thank you.